Chapters of Life by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 10, The Works of Man. The old engineer smiled fondly down at the small figure resting on the bench. Straightening, he placed his hands to his aching back and rose stiffly to greet his visitor. "Nice of you to come and see me," said the engineer affably. "I certainly have a problem here." Taking the visitor's arm, he led him over to the workbench. "There he is," he said, like a proud parent. "The latest model. Experimental still, you know. And there are some unexpected difficulties. I can't solve them. Too close to the subject, I guess." Gently, he picked up the little figure and rested it on the palm of one hand. The visitor glanced around. "Quite a nice place you've got here," he commented. "You seem to have some thriving colonies, even though this lot is difficult." "Not so thriving as you think," replied the engineer gloomily. "Come and look at these." Cradling the small figure in his hands, he led the way to a small blue-green sphere. "There is a viewer there. Have a look. Tell me what you think." The visitor placed his eyes against the viewer and twisted some knobs. For some moments he watched and then, with a sigh, pushed the viewer away. "Ah, truculent lot, aren't they?" he asked. "It seems to me that they're crazy." For long moments the engineer stood in silence, idly fingering the little figure in his hand. "Crazy," he mused. "Crazy? Why, yes, I suppose so. It seems to me that they have a remote control problem or something. They do not respond correctly to transmitted signals, nor do they return the correct information. I don't know what to do about it." Turning, he paced up and down, lost in deep thought, head bent in profound contemplation of the figure in his hands. At last he abruptly halted in front of his visitor and asked brusquely, "What would you do if you were in my position? The board is making difficulties over all the delay in getting them right. What would you do?" Without replying, the visitor turned to the viewer again and peered through it with intense concentration. Carefully, he focused and refocused until he was quite satisfied. Then, for a long time, he peered through the instrument. At last, he turned to the impatiently waiting engineer and said, "You should send an observer down. Shouldn't be impossible. It's the only way to get results, you know. We are too far away here. We can only guess, and so far, we've guessed wrongly. Nothing else for it, but on second thoughts, why not call in a specialist efficiency expert?" The engineer shook his head doubtfully. "No," he replied. "The board would never stand for it. I don't think they would even cooperate with an outside specialist." Together, engineer and visitor strolled over to the workbench and sat down. "Here," said the engineer, picking a figure from a box. "It's the newest model. Homo sapiens, we call them, but they seem to have lost the sapiens for the moment." The visitor took the figure and examined it carefully. "Here's another," added the engineer, as he took another little figure from a box on the other side of the bench. The visitor examined the second figure and compared it with the first. "Self-reproducing," remarked the engineer. "When they reach a certain age and they get together, they reproduce. Actually, Each has just the same equipment as the other, but in more or less degree. We call one male and the other female. They work by remote control, but just now the control is faulty and we don't know why. The visitor pointed to another box. What are those? He asked. The engineer made a rueful face. Oh, they are subnormal, he said. They do not know truth from untruth. We call them press men, journalists. Yes, humans are a bit of a mess, all right. Quite an intricate mechanism, which at the present time does not seem to be functioning as well as it should. We have to remember that in our solar system, we are composed of compounds which are rather different from those existing in other universes, other galaxies, etc. Here, everything that lives on our Earth is composed of the same bricks. There are available in this solar system hydrogen, water, and hydrates, ammonia, methane, and various other gases. We are really composed of bricks of carbon molecules and amino acids and nucleotides. From these simple compounds are built all the species of animals, plants, and minerals upon Earth. When that is built into human shape, the resulting mechanism is subject to magnetic impulses, which we call astrological impulses, and various rays. But let us go into the matter a little more deeply and see what we can find out. If you can get an illustration of a human body, and you can see the spine and spinal nerves, you will be able to follow this more accurately. The human mechanism, the controller mechanism that is actually composed of 9 control centers. The average occultist mentions only 7 because there are 7 upon the material or mundane plane. The old Chinese physicians visualized all the organs of the body as being controlled and supervised by little men. And here in this chapter, you will see an illustration adapted from one which was originally drawn in China about 7,000 years ago. You can see the little men helping the passage of food down the throat, blowing wind into the lungs, stirring up all the chemicals in the liver, and controlling various sphincters. But this dealt with merely the animal part of the body, the flesh and organs. We want to go farther than that and deal with the parts which bring messages from the over-self and control the functions of the body. We have to remember that there is very much more to the human body than meets the casual eye. If we look at a pair of wires going, let us say, past our window on telegraph poles or similar, we cannot tell by looking at those wires if any current is flowing. To us, they're just copper wires. But with suitable instruments, one can detect whether there be or not current flowing, and we can also determine which way it is flowing. In the same way, we can look at the body without necessarily being aware of the various centers of that body, which are connected to equivalent portions of the over-self. As already stated, there are 7 mundane centers, which are called chakras. At the top of the head, there is the one frequently referred to as the 1,000-petaled lotus. The actual Sanskrit name is Sahasrara Chakra. This is the relay or center, which is nearest to the spiritual and thus the one which is more easily deranged. Lower, we are looking at a body from the back, and we see the head, shoulders, and spine, etc. Around about the neck area is the Ajna chakra. This is the next important and which is actually in contact with the over-self. This is the chakra of the mind. And remember that the mind is just as an electrical function in much the same way as you can receive a telephone message. And the earpiece is just a function of what is being said at the other end of the wire. Farther down the spine, we have the third chakra. This one is known as Vishuddha. This controls the action of the mouth. So, if one has difficulty in speaking clearly, it could be that this chakra is undisciplined or damaged. To digress for a moment, just imagine that you are walking along a street and you see a telephone man messing about in one of those manholes. As you stop to look, he gets hold of a great sheathed cable and tears the insulation off of it. As the insulation is removed, you see thousands of tiny wires, most of them color-coated. But anyway, there are thousands of wires, and you wonder how on earth anyone can sort out such a mess. Well, the nerves inside your spine are like that. Certain nerves go down inside the spine and then branch away. So, when you are thinking of chakras, think of a telephone man with all those wires, and think also of little relays or repeater stations, which take an incoming signal from a distant station and amplify it or make it stronger before sending it on to the next station in the line. Next of our relays is the Anahata chakra, which controls feeling and all that we touch. Below that, there is the Manipura chakra. This one is known as the fire principle chakra, and there is no point in going more deeply into this particular chakra because it does not greatly concern us at this stage. Below that, we have the sixth chakra, this time the Swadhisthana chakra. This one deals with the water principle. Farther down, we have the seventh or earth principle chakra, referred to in Sanskrit as a Muladhara. This one is the home of the Kundalini, and the Kundalini is actually the controlling or life force of humans. It is, let us say, the equivalent of the fire in the furnace which heats the water to raise the steam, which turns the turbines to generate the electricity, which lights the lamps, cools the fridge, etc. in civilization. Once the fire goes out, the electricity dies through want of steam, and everything else comes to a standstill. Many people who have been misinstructed, or worse, have been uninstructed, try to raise the Kundalini force by artificial means, because it is a fact that if one raises the Kundalini properly, one can be very much more aware, very much more intelligent. But to raise it indiscriminately, without having utter purity of thought, is to do immense harm to oneself, and frequently to lead to madness. To raise the Kundalini without thought of the consequences can lead to a complete mental and physical breakdown. So, unless you have a master who has been through it all and knows all about it, do not try to raise your own Kundalini. A master will not raise the Kundalini unless he is quite sure that it is for your good. Here it might be as well to add that people who run correspondence courses, etc., or offer to do small services for you for a small sum of money, do not have the power to safely supervise your development and raise your kundalini. They can do a lot of harm instead. Before a physical entity of the human type, that is, a person living on this world, can attain to cosmic consciousness, he or she has to have certain stirrings of the kundalini. Stirrings are somewhat different from actually raising the kundalini. If one is sexually overexcited and, let me say it, lustful, it can be a bad thing indeed, because if one has sex for the sake of sex only, sex without true love, that is, it can temporarily or permanently paralyze the correct flowing of the kundalini force. By permanently, I mean during this lifetime, as long as the malpractice in sex continues. Each part of the body, while upon the earth, is strongly associated and connected to its astral counterpart by way of all these chakras. No doubt you've heard of the people who have had a leg amputated and who still apparently feel pains in the amputated leg, or rather in the space which the amputated leg would have filled. This is because the physical leg which now has been removed still has certain effects upon the astral leg, which of course has not and cannot be removed. To refer again to astral travel, it is highly essential that we return to the physical body so that every part of the astral body fits into every part of the physical body, and so that astral and physical organs are completely compatible each with the other. The bodies must also be correctly synchronized according to the direction of current flow. Just as all current, all electricity, must be either positive or negative, just as current can flow in one direction and return in the opposite direction, so do humans have a flow of current. The two wires of humans are known as the Ida and Pingala. Actually, of course, they're not wires, but tubes in the human body. Ida is on the left side, and Pingala is on the right side. And these two sources provide the energy necessary for the passive functioning of the kundalini. You can look upon them as caretakers, making sure that the kundalini is kept in good condition, ready for use in this life, if we deserve it, or, if not, ready for use in the next life, because when the kundalini starts to rise under correct treatment and under correct control, Ida and Pingala are bypassed. But so long as man and woman are bound by the operation of Ida and Pingala, that man or woman will be confined to the earth plane and to the theory and practice of birth, death, and rebirth. It is only when man is able to raise his kundalini and bypass the caretaking energy sources of Ida and Pingala that he can progress and know that his time of release from the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth has come to an end. It is better to regard these chakras as relay stations, or, if you like, remote control spots. Remember also that there are other important parts of the body, such as the cervical ganglion in the neck, and somewhat below it, the vagus nerve. After that, we have the cardiac plexus, the solar plexus, and the pelvic plexus. But these are substations and should not bother us unduly. We upon Earth are affected very greatly by all sorts of outside influences. There are various rays which affect humans. And let me say at the outset that astrology is a very, very real thing indeed, and people should not sneer at it. One should only sneer at the practitioners who misrepresent astrology, because to do astrology properly takes a long time and entails a lot of work, so much time and so much work that it is not a commercial proposition. Certainly, you cannot get anything of a worthwhile reading by looking at the columns of the daily newspaper and reading your horoscope. The rays are a form of offshoot of cosmic rays, and according to the time of day and your own latitude and longitude, you are subject to certain rays. How the rays affect you depends upon your astrological makeup. There are, for example, the orange, the yellow, green, blue, indigo, and others, but it will be far too much to go into the principle of these rays in a book of this nature. Let us say, though, that as one gets to the red end of the spectrum, one finds that one is dealing with the development of individuality, and the purple is concerned with a group mind, while a green ray tends to give one an impetus to learning. The yellow ray itself is the ray of wisdom. One of the more interesting of the rays is the blue ray, which is supposed to come under the domination of Hermes. In ancient Egypt and Chaldea, it was known as the magician's ray. Of more use to us at the moment are the zodiac signs. Imagine that you had a large ball bearing on a smooth, level surface. Then, if you arrange magnets all around it, you could hold the ball bearing in one position. And by juggling with the position of the magnets, you could make the ball bearing take up any desired position. Look upon the planets as the magnets, and yourself as the ball bearing. Our first magnet is the sun, but it manifests in what we call the seventh plane of the abstract spiritual consciousness. The result of the sun's influence is to give life and to cause life to flourish. Our next magnet shall be Jupiter. Jupiter is jovial, benevolent, kind. Here it refers to the sixth plane of spiritual consciousness. It is a beneficent planet and gives good balance in morals. Everyone knows that jovial people are happy people and good to know. Our next magnet is Mercury, which has the fifth plane of abstract mind. It makes people sharp-witted and jumpy. It leads to astute business deals. People understand perfectly what is meant by a mercurial type. Mercury, the god who delivered messages, is supposed to control this fifth plane, which also gives good memory. Our fourth position is Saturn. This is coming down to solid consciousness. Saturnine people dwell upon things, and it is often the opposite to the jovial temperament. Saturn people are limited, restricted, and stern. people who have overabundance of this particular sign have to get patience and stability before they can progress further. Now we come to Venus, our magnet occupying the third plane of the abstract emotions. Everyone knows that Venus is the goddess of love. It is also a mildly benevolent planet. It makes people have higher ideals and emotions. It causes people to develop their own personalities and individuality. Venus people can be beautiful people unless they are too closely associated with malefics. Our second plane is Mars. It is also our sixth magnet. Mars, martial and warlike, is known as the Energizer. It can be a mildly bad effect planet if its powers are not correctly used. Mars dominates the physical body and, frequently, sex desires. If correctly used, Mars increases the consciousness and increases courage, strength, and endurance. Lastly, our seventh influence is the Moon. Well, everyone knows what the Moon does. It has an extreme effect on human life. It causes the tides to rise and fall, not merely at sea, but also in the human body. Think of the woman's tide every month. Think of the word lunatic from lunar, the moon. The moon has no light of her own. She reflects only that which is shone upon her. Thus, a person who has too much moon influence has no great personality of his own. He merely reflects the views and opinions of those around him. Probably, almost everyone has heard of twin souls. There are such things, you know, but upon the earth plane, the meeting of twin souls is a very rare occurrence. You see, if you're going to get down to basics and you consider the world of antimatter, you will appreciate that to be a complete battery, there must be a positive and a negative. So, if you're going to have a twin soul, which forms one complete entity, you have to get a person in our system of the astral and a person of the corresponding system of the antimatter astral, and these people have to be completely compatible. What usually happens here, however, is that in the astral there are two overselves who are highly compatible, and they send down to Earth a puppet from each, and the puppet from each is completely compatible with the other. They fit in, and if they come into close proximity with each other, there is an immediate feeling of rapport, of belonging. One will say, "I know I've met that person before." In such cases, a very true friendship can develop. But as already stated, such instances are rather rare upon the earth. Instead, there is often a very great degree of compatibility between two people, and because they are so compatible, because they complement each other, they consider that they are twin souls. They may get each other's thoughts. They may know just what the other is going to say seconds before it is said. One gets much the same sort of affair between identical twins, which, of course, is two people from the one egg. These two will be very much in sympathy with each other, and even while miles apart, will experience the emotion of the other, and they may even get married at the same time. A man can be very much in love with a woman, They may fancy that they are twin souls, but if they are twin souls, then they will have similar interests. For example, the man could not, let us say, be a confirmed atheist, while the woman had very strong religious beliefs. The dissimilarity in their beliefs would cause dissonance, cause some disharmony, some friction between them, and so instead of drawing closer together, they would drift farther apart. The most that can be hoped for on this world is that two highly compatible people can live together, and by their purity of thought and by their actions, draw each closer to the other. But this is difficult to attain at the present time because it requires such utter sacrifice and selflessness. It is useless for a man to give in and give all to the woman, thinking that he's doing right, just as it is useless for the woman to give all to the man and think that she is doing right. It is not enough that each give everything to the other. Instead, each must give exactly what the other needs. Otherwise, they will drift apart. Many people think that they have met their twin soul when they meet a person who astrologically is compatible and who lives upon the same ray. They can live in harmony, and they will live in harmony, but it is still not perfect harmony. It still is not a fusion of two souls to make one entity. In fact, if people were so perfect as that, they could not stay upon this imperfect world any more than a piece of ice can exist when tossed into the flames of a raging furnace. Thus, humans, man and woman, must try to live with each other, exercising tolerance, patience, and selflessness. Quite a number of people are brought together to work out karmic links, and the working out of these karmic ties makes it necessary that people shall come in close contact with each other for good or for bad. If a man and woman are brought together through karmic ties and, for example, the man falls in love with the woman, and the woman falls in love with the man, then a very great bond of love is formed, which can have the effect of cancelling out many bad karmic aspects, because no matter what we think down here, good will prevail in the end. If one person loves another, and the other person hates the former, then a karmic bond will still be formed, but it will be an unsatisfactory bond, and they will have to come together until the hate is eradicated and love forms. It should be understood that only complete and utter indifference can possibly prevent any karmic link being formed. If you like a person, you form a karmic tie. If you dislike a person, you form a karmic tie. If you couldn't care less about the person, no link is formed. So, any reaction to any other person starts the chain which causes karma. For example, there could be a relationship between a teacher and a student. In that case, a bond of some sort is formed. It could be a lasting bond, or it may be just a temporary bond, which is over almost in a flash, and can then be attributed to the burning out of some karmic link. The worst state is that in which great love is severed by death. If a woman loses her husband while she's still in love with him, she has no outlet for her love, and so that love is stored up until they come together again in some future incarnation, and the conditions are right for the expression of that love. So if anyone tells you that he or she has met their twin soul, smile understandingly and hold your peace. These wretched old bodies of ours are subject to all sorts of weird ailments, just as an intricate piece of apparatus can be jarred out of adjustment. So can human bodies be shaken somewhat out of their best condition. So as many people desire to be healers, it might not be out of place to give a little about healing treatment here. After all, we are dealing with the works of man. This is the negative world, from which it follows that a negative treatment is most suitable. That, then, is the actual term which one uses in describing this particular treatment. Negative treatment. First, you have to get rid of as much breath as you can from your lungs. Really exhale. Force the air out and stay like that for as long as you can without too much discomfort. This enables the body to attain what we might call negative polarity, because it is now deficient in prana, deficient in air. Then, breathe lightly for just a few moments to get your breath back, so to speak. Then repeat the whole affair by exhaling as thoroughly as possible and getting the air out of your lungs. Stay with empty lungs for as long as you can without too much discomfort or killing yourself. Then breathe again lightly. And when you've got some breath back, do this system once again, so that you have done it in all 3 times. 3 times you have exhaled completely and let your body become negatively polarized. Now, you know where you are hurting, so place your hand over the skin at the site to be treated. Then, withdraw the hand, the palm, so that only the forefinger and the thumb are pressed firmly upon the skin. Hold your finger and thumb firmly upon the area to be treated. Then again, exhale and stop breathing. While you are thus stopping breathing, vividly imagine the life force flowing out of your left fingertip into the part that you desire to be treated. Soon, you will have to breathe again, but breathe as shallowly as possible, taking in just enough air to sustain life, and then hold the fingers still in contact with the area being treated. You should repeat this 3 times, and each time you should hold your fingers in contact with the area for at least 2 minutes. The best way to treat yourself, really, is to give this treatment every hour until you are very much recovered. These treatments do work because you are calling in outside forces. If you are subject to colds and you get your head stuffed up, you can greatly relieve the condition by giving this negative treatment. In this case, you would place your finger and thumb, one on each side of the nose, just below the eyes. Then again, you would hold your breath after you had expelled as much air as possible. Again, you would picture that life force flowing into you, into your nose, and killing off all the bugs which are causing the trouble. Quite seriously, I say to you, that if you try this, you will very shortly feel a crackling in the nose as congestion dissipates. You will find that you will then be able to breathe through your nostrils. Asthma is a complaint which is but little understood. All sorts of nostrums are prescribed for asthma, but in many, many cases, asthma is caused by some nervous condition, and that nervous condition will respond to this form of treatment. In this case, you put the finger and the thumb on either side of the throat, just above the Adam's apple. That is for the ordinary type of asthma. But of course, if you have the type which causes truly harsh and painful breathing, then you will have to put your finger and thumb some 3 inches apart and place them where you can feel the throat join the chest. Naturally enough, if you have had asthma for many years, you cannot expect a cure in a few seconds. You must have patience and use common sense. But if you will persist in this treatment, you will quite definitely find that the asthma will disappear. It will disappear a whole lot faster if you will do a little meditation and introspection and reason out for yourself what is it that causes your nervous disturbance. Again, many, many cases of asthma are caused by nervous worry, and the asthma just acts like a safety valve and gives you an out. Let me repeat that you must follow these instructions exactly, and you must always use your left hand. You cannot get a strong negative cure by using your right hand. Remember then, get the air out of your lungs, wait a little with empty lungs, and always use your left hand. You will find that even a severe burn will respond to treatment of this nature. In that case, of course, you use a forefinger and thumb and place them upon the burn and proceed with the treatment. You will appreciate, of course, that if you have a very severe burn, well, the sooner you can get to a doctor, the better. But you can do your own treatment while waiting for him. The Kundalini, as already stated, is the furnace of the human body, and of course it and the brain can be regarded as the opposite poles of a magnet, if you prefer the magnet theory instead of that of the furnace. But supposing you are very clairvoyant and you have a nude body before you which you can study, let us see how it would appear. We have a wall covered preferably in black velvet. The wall is about 14 feet square, and we have a little platform about 4 feet from the floor. Upon that platform, a nude model stands with back to the velvet. As we stand facing the model and observing clairvoyantly, we see a brilliant white streak, which is the coursing current between brain and kundalini, which, as already stated, is at the remote end of the spine, a bit lower than the spine, actually. You may have seen those white strip lights in shops or by the side of dressing mirrors. Well, suppose you imagine that the clairvoyant sight lets you see the life force as resembling a strip of that light. First, you have that brilliant strip of light extending from the top of the brain of your subject and descending to a few inches below the termination of the spine. You look at that for some seconds, observing how it fluctuates and pulsates, first being as a thin strip, and then as some other thought occurs to your subject, expanding until it is quite a broad band. If you are experienced at this sort of thing, you will, after seeing this, be able to see that the body is outlined with a bluish light, very much like the bluish smoke of a burning cigarette. If you light a cigarette and let it burn, it gives off a bluish smoke, which is quite different from the smoke which is exhaled by a smoker. This bluish light, it looks very much like a luminous smoke, extends from the surface of the body and is of a uniform thickness, the thickness depending upon the health and strength of the subject. In an elderly person, it may be about half an inch in width. In a really vigorous person, it may extend 2 or 3 inches or even 4. That is the etheric, and is just the animal radiation of a body. The aura is superimposed over all of it. The aura extends up beyond the head, and if you are clairvoyant enough, you will see from the center of the head a play of light which looks very much like a little fountain, bubbling and sparkling and changing colors. It changes colors according to the thoughts of the person. Well, around the head, you will see the halo or nimbus. It looks like, well, everyone knows what a halo looks like, even if they haven't really much hope of achieving one. But perhaps we should describe the halo. It looks like a golden disc. The degree of gold or color or shade of gold depends upon the spirituality and degree of evolution of the person concerned. If the person is very carnal, then the gold will be a very reddish color. If the person is spiritual and learning to be more spiritual, the gold will have a greenish patina. The more spiritual the person, the more does yellow appear in the gold. About the body, there are swirls of color. Actually, there are more colors than can be described in earth terms, because these are colors, shades, hues, etc., beyond the body encompassed range of words. They swirl about the head, the eyes, the nose and mouth and throat. They swirl about the breast, the umbilicus, the sex organs. And then the swirling becomes less intense about the knees, although there is considerable radiance from the backs of the knees. The color becomes less and more uniform as the aura descends to the ankles and to the feet. Our model is standing 4 feet, we said, from the floor, and so with the average person, the bottom part of the egg-shaped covering of the aura will be just touching the floor, 4 feet below the petal extremities of the model. The sheath is egg-shaped, with pointed end down. If you extend your arms at full length, then normally you would be just touching the outer limits of the auric sheath. The colors of the aura flow and twirl and intertwine with other colors. It is a constant shimmering of other colors, and although it is a remarkably poor illustration, I can only say that as colors of spilled oil or petroleum shimmer upon water, so do the colors of the aura shimmer upon a person, but more so. Every color has meaning. Every striation has meaning. Not only that, but the direction of flow has meaning too. Imagine that you have an egg and you wrap around that egg all manner of silks of different colors. You will wind them backwards and forth, up and down, never using the same color twice. Well, that will give you a crude, very crude, idea of what the aura looks like. You see the aura, you see the etheric, and you see within the sharp burning light, which is the life force itself. It is rather difficult to explain, but you can see all three without one interfering with the others. Perhaps a good way to illustrate it would be this. You're sitting out in the open, and you have a big landscape in front of you. Now, to your sight, you have vision from a few inches from your face to limitless miles. If you want to focus on your hand, you raise your hand in front of your face, and you can see the lines on your palm. As you see this, you can still be conscious of the view in the background, but it does not intrude or distract your study of your hand. That represents, let us say, you looking at the aura and the auric sheath. Now let's go a stage farther. 10 feet away from you, there is a person sitting on a chair. You can look at that person and see him or her clearly. You can still be aware of your hand close to your face and still be aware of the landscape in the distance, and neither the distant landscape nor the closeness of your hand impinges on your study of the person sitting 10 feet from you. That is as looking at the etheric. Now, to look at the life force shining so brightly between the brain and the kundalini, one can say that we raise our eyes away from the person sitting in the chair and we survey the landscape, perhaps the setting sun or, if you prefer, and more suitable to this illustration, the rising sun. You can be aware of the rising sun, and you can study that landscape without being affected by the person sitting in the chair 10 feet away from you, or by your hand, which is a few inches from you. Thus, it is clear that you can see aura, etheric, and kundalini force, depending on which way you shift or focus your clairvoyant sight. The purpose of the black velvet background is that it avoids people becoming distracted. For example, if you have a light switch on the wall or a picture or a mirror, then your sight becomes instinctively attracted by a reflection or a glittering point of light. And if your physical sight becomes so distracted, it can distract your clairvoyant sight. For best results, one should have a matte black background, one quite without pattern, and of course you must have a nude model, because if your model has clothes, then your clairvoyant sight is going to be led astray by color emanations from the clothes. In just the same way, if you're looking at the sun, and you pull curtains across the window, the light of the sun undergoes an apparent change depending upon the color of the curtains. Another way to look at it is, you have an electric light burning. It has no shade, so you see the color actually emitted by the naked bulb. Now, if you're going to put a colored shade over the bulb, the apparent color will be distorted by the intermingling of the natural color of the unshaded bulb and the color of the material of the shade. So you will be led astray. We get a similar thing in photography when, if you want to take a photograph in color using daylight film, but you take a photograph by artificial light, we get all our color renderings wrong. So, if you are serious, you must have a nude model, And there's nothing wrong with the nude model, remember, but only by the thoughts of people who are led astray by something we shall deal with in chapter 11 in one of the questions about sex. The old Chinese, and later copied by Japanese, liked to think that all the organs of the body had little men looking after them. Well, they weren't so far wrong, you know, because all the organs of the body are connected to the brain by various nerves, and the brain is aware of what is happening to every part of every organ of the body. The functions of an organ used to be within the conscious control of the human, but now, because people neglected such things, control of the organs is largely automatic. There are many adepts who can consciously control the functioning of their organs. In India, fakirs, who are usually debased adepts, give demonstrations of such control. They can stick a knife through the palm of their hand, and on withdrawing the knife, they can cause the wound to heal within minutes. These things are very real, but nowadays control of the organs is largely lost. The illustrations with this chapter is well worth studying because you will see that the fanciful artist has caused little monks and acolytes under the supervision of lamas to control all the functions of the body. This is much the same as the monitor system, which warns the brain when any damage or malfunction is about to occur. It is also worth visualizing your body as being controlled by these little people, because then, when you want to meditate deeply, you, by controlling these little people, can obtain complete meditation. All you have to do is, as stated in various others of my books, make the little people leave the body and congregate outside the body so that your consciousness is withdrawn. You can make the little people march up your legs from your toes, and then your toes and your legs become relaxed and at peace. Make the little people leave your kidneys and your bowels and your gallbladder, etc., and you will find that you really do get complete and utter relaxation. And when you have such complete and utter relaxation, you're able to do the deepest of deep meditations and obtain what are truly revelations from another world. Try it, but first of all, read up about this system in other of my books. I do not want to go into it all here, because sure enough, someone will say that I have nothing else to write about and I have taken to repeating myself. End of chapter 10.